Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the February 15th Tuesday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. COVID-19 in Colorado. State passes 12,000 deaths, hospitalizations, and new cases have continued to drop as Omicron-fueled wave recedes. By Meg Wingerder. Mesa County Clerk Peters to run for Secretary of State. Republican who is subject of several investigations is fourth to join GOP race. By Saja Hindi. Former Kent, Denver teacher, ex-Navy engineer, pleads guilty to trying to sell secrets. By Alex Mann. Climate change, mega drought in the West. Study says 22-year dry spell has surpassed previous worst from 1500s amid rough times in 2020 and 2021. By Seth Borenstein. And following up with miscellaneous articles. COVID-19 in Colorado. State passes 12,000 deaths. Hospitalizations and new cases have continued to drop as the Omicron-fueled wave recedes. By Meg Wingerder, The Denver Post. More than 12,000 people have died of COVID-19 in Colorado since the start of the pandemic, with 2,000 of those deaths coming after the worst of the fall's Delta wave was over. As of Monday afternoon, 12,112 people were confirmed to have died of the virus in the state. The total, compiled by the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, could include some people who weren't Colorado residents, but who died while receiving care here. The milestone came as the state's sixth wave, fueled by the virus's Omicron variant, which followed the Delta variant surge, continued to recede, with both cases and hospitalizations dropping over the last week. The State Health Department reported 705 people were hospitalized in Colorado with confirmed COVID-19 as of Monday afternoon, the lowest number since late August. The number of new cases was at its lowest level since mid-December, with 12,386 reported in the week ending Sunday. The positivity rate also continued to fall, with about 7.8% of tests finding the virus that causes COVID-19 over the last week. The goal is for that number to be below 5%. Transmission is still high, though, so it's still a good idea to wear your mask indoors and get a booster shot if you haven't, said Talia Quandalesi, an assistant professor of epidemiology at the Colorado School of Public Health. Assuming a new variant doesn't appear and it cause another wave, the rate of new deaths should start decreasing in the near future. So far, the BA2 subvariant, a close relative of Omicron, isn't taking off in Colorado, and it appears unlikely to trigger another surge, Quandalesi said. Colorado recorded 10,000 deaths 2 months earlier, on December 14th, the one-year anniversary of the first batch of COVID-19 vaccines arriving in Colorado. At the time, the worst of the Delta-driven fifth wave was over, and new deaths were expected to keep dropping for some time. Then Omicron hit, and deaths were rising again by mid-January. Deaths always lag behind cases and hospitalizations because it often takes the virus weeks to kill someone. That means that efforts to prevent people from dying have to start before deaths are rising. The state doesn't classify which variant killed people who died of COVID-19, so it's impossible to know exactly how many deaths were caused by Omicron and how many were from the Delta variant. It's likely that most of the deaths since mid-January are attributable to Omicron. However, because Delta was on its way out by mid-December, Quandalese said. As Omicron began to take over, we would start to see a shift, she said. The odds any given person who is infected would die of their illness were significantly lower in the period when Omicron dominated than they were when Delta held sway. But because Omicron was so contagious, it infected a huge swath of the state, including people who were vulnerable to severe illness because they remained unvaccinated, were older, or had health conditions that put them at risk, Quandalese said. You could still have a fairly serious infection with Omicron, she said. State-level data about the vaccination status of people who died in January isn't yet available, but the hospitalization risk was about 11 times as high for unvaccinated people as it was for people who have had a booster dose. People who are fully vaccinated but didn't have a third shot had an intermediate risk level. During the worst week of the wave that's now resolving, an average of 41 people died each day, comparable to 39 daily deaths during the peak week of the Delta wave in November. Fortunately, the state hasn't again seen anything close to December 2020, when COVID-19 took 69 people each day at the highest point. Though the current wave's peak deaths were higher, the fifth wave likely killed more people. So far, 1,071 people have died since the low point at the end of the fifth wave. And while that's likely to continue rising, it's not expected to go as high as the 3,659 deaths reported during the long fifth wave, which began in July and ended in December. Omicron did move through the population much faster than the other variants, Quandalese said. Mesa County Clerk Peters to run for Secretary of State. Republican who is subject of several investigations is fourth to join GOP race by Saja Hindi, the Denver Post. Republican Mesa County Clerk and Recorder Tina Peters announced she's running for Colorado Secretary of State this year while she continues to be the subject of ongoing federal, local, and state investigations. The clerk and recorder, who has embraced 2020 election conspiracy theories, made the announcement on an online show posted Monday that's hosted by Steve Bannon, the former advisor to President Donald Trump, who is facing criminal contempt of Congress charges by a federal grand jury. Peters, who Bannon referred to as a hero, is seeking to unseat incumbent Democratic Secretary of State Gina Griswold. I want to keep elections local. I want to fight against the Biden and the radical left to take over our vote. And I am the wall between your vote and nationalized elections, Peters said on the show. Peters is vying for the state's top election position amid a grand jury investigation into allegations of election equipment tampering and official misconduct in Mesa County that launched last month. She is also facing multiple ethics and campaign finance violations and was barred by a Mesa County District Court judge from overseeing the 2021 election. The Secretary of State filed another lawsuit hoping to prevent Peters from overseeing the 2022 election after Peters refused to repudiate a statement she made about Dominion voting machines and agree to additional election security protocols. The Mesa County clerk was also arrested last week on allegations of obstruction while officers attempted to execute a search warrant for an iPad that belonged to her. She is under investigation for a possible felony attempt to influence a public servant for allegedly recording or attempting to record a court hearing against a judge's order. In a written statement from her campaign, Griswold called Peters unfit to serve as Secretary of State and said she was a danger to Colorado elections. Colorado needs a Secretary of State who will uphold the will of the people, not one who embraces conspiracies and risks Coloradans' right to vote, Griswold said. Peters had initially announced at a news conference on the same day as a grand jury announcement that she was running for re-election as Mesa County Clerk and Recorder. the position she was elected to in 2018. She cannot run for both positions, but had not filed paperwork for the Secretary of State candidacy as of Monday morning, according to the Secretary of State's office. She joins three other Republicans in the June 28th primary for Secretary of State, including former Jefferson County Clerk and Recorder Pam Anderson, who has rejected lies about the 2020 election. The other two candidates are Mike O'Donnell, who has questioned the security of Dominion voting machines and asserted that non-citizens are registering to vote in Colorado elections, and David Winney, who has called for a comprehensive forensic audit for all 2020 elections in Colorado. Across the country, 2020 election deniers are campaigning for secretaries of state, positions that did not garner the attention or money they have in the 2022 midterms. Bannon said on his show that Colorado may not be a battleground state yet, but it should be. Elections Integrity fellow David Levine of the German Marshall Fund's Alliance for Securing Democracy said, "Peter's decision to run for Secretary of State is the latest example of the sad fact that today we have many people seeking to become the chief election officers who wouldn't be able to tell a free and fair election from a rigged one. It's imperative that Colorado voters and voters across the country, when they're thinking about who they want to cast ballots for or who they want to support, they ought to be thinking about who's going to put the conduct of free and fair elections above any person, partisan, or personal interest," Levine said. The Colorado Republican Party support has already been consolidated around Anderson, and it's unlikely that Peters will make it out of the GOP primary, let alone the general election, said Republican political strategist Ryan Lynch. "I really believe that most people within the Republican base see Tina for what she is, and that's a troubled person who would be a pretty tremendous liability for the GOP ticket as a whole in November, should she be the Republican nominee for Secretary of State," Lynch said. He noted that she's at odds with Mesa County's Republican elected officials. Anderson is petitioning onto the ballot, and Lynch expects Peters to go through the party assembly because of the cost involved in petitioning. "I think Tina probably sucks all the oxygen out of O'Donnell and Winnie's campaigns," Lynch said, "but her impact on Pam, I think, would be negligible and may actually end up benefiting Pam because of the increased coverage of the race." Former Kent, Denver teacher, ex-Navy engineer, pleads guilty to trying to sell secrets, by Alex Mann, the Baltimore Sun. A former Navy nuclear engineer who once taught prep school in Metro Denver pleaded guilty to espionage Monday, admitting in federal court that he tried to sell classified military information about U.S. submarines to a foreign government. Jonathan Toby of Annapolis, Maryland, entered the guilty plea in the W. Craig Broadwater Federal Building and United States Courthouse in Martinsburg, West Virginia, which is not far from where he and his wife, Diana, were arrested in October. The Tobys both were employed as teachers by Kent Denver, a private prep school in Englewood, in the mid-2000s. Jonathan Toby taught at the school from 2005 to 2008, while Diana Toby worked there as a teacher from 2005 to 2012, according to a school spokeswoman. Having worked since 2012 on projects related to naval nuclear propulsion, Toby held a top secret security clearance, according to federal investigators. They said it's possible he'd been collecting information related to the Navy's nuclear endeavors throughout his tenure, and at some point in 2020, sought out a foreign country to share it with. In April 2020, Toby sent a sample of restricted data to a country not identified in court records, asking the recipient to share it with their country's military intelligence agency and promising his information would be of great value to your nation, according to court records. Toby's letter was shared with an FBI attaché, prompting federal agents to launch an undercover operation. Over more than a year, undercover agents communicated with Toby over an encrypted email service and facilitated the displaying of a discrete signal in Washington, D.C., as well as a series of dead drops in 2021 in West Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Virginia. The agents would transfer cryptocurrency to Tobit after picking up the SD cards he left in predetermined locations. Tobit concealed the digital memory devices in a peanut butter sandwich, a Band-Aid wrapper, and a chewing gum package. In sum, the government paid Tobit the equivalent of $100,000 in cryptocurrency. Federal prosecutors said in October, the government has not located the money it paid Tobit. In each exchange of information, agents gleaned more about the people they were dealing with. Jonathan, the nuclear engineer, and Diana, 46, a humanities teacher at the Key School in Annapolis. The FBI followed the couple to the drop sites and watched them deposit the information, accusing Diana Tobit of acting as a lookout. Jonathan Tobit wrote in an encrypted email, "Only one other person I know is aware of our special relationship." And federal agents wrote in their original complaint, they believe that person was his wife. A federal grand jury indicted the couple October 19th. The husband and wife have insisted Diana Tobit is innocent. Her attorneys pushed for her release pending trial, arguing she wasn't privy to her husband's scheme to divulge classified information. A magistrate judge denied that request, and she appealed. It's unclear what, if any, implications Jonathan Tobit's plea has had on his wife's case. According to court records, Jonathan Tobit provided thousands of pages of documents with schematic designs, operating parameters, and performance characteristics about nuclear-powered cruise missile fast-attack submarines, known in the military as Virginia-class submarines. Tobit signed every encrypted email as Alice, describing the format of the information he provided and often expressing concerns about the possibility that he may be communicating with law enforcement, which he regularly referred to as adversaries. "Thank you for your partnership as well, my friend," Jonathan Tobit wrote in an encrypted email to a federal agent. "One day, when it is safe, perhaps two old friends will have a chance to stumble into each other at a cafe, share a bottle of wine, and laugh over stories of their shared exploits." Climate change. Mega drought in the West. Study says 22-year dry spell has surpassed previous worst from 1500s amid rough times in 2020 and 2021. By Seth Borenstein, The Associated Press. The American West's mega drought deepened so much last year that is now the driest in at least 1,200 years and is a worst-case climate change scenario playing out live, a new study finds. A dramatic drying in 2021, about as dry as 2002, and one of the driest years ever recorded for the region, pushed the 22-year drought past the previous record holder for mega droughts in the late 1500s and shows no signs of easing in the near future, according to a study Monday in the journal Nature Climate Change. The study calculated that 42% of this mega drought can be attributed to human-caused climate change. Climate change is changing the baseline conditions toward a drier, gradually drier state in the West, and that means the worst-case scenario keeps getting worse, said study lead author Park Williams, a climate hydrologist at UCLA. This is right in line with what people were thinking of in the 1900s as a worst-case scenario. But today, I think we need to be even preparing for conditions in the future that are far worse than this. Williams studied soil moisture levels in the West, a box that includes California, Wyoming, Utah, Nevada, Arizona, most of Oregon and Idaho, much of New Mexico, western Colorado, northern Mexico, and the southwest corners of Montana and Texas. Using modern measurements and tree rings for estimates that go back to the year 800, that's about as far back as estimates can reliably go with tree rings. A few years ago, Williams studied the current drought and said it qualified as a lengthy and deep mega drought, and that the only worse one was in the 1500s. He figured the current drought wouldn't surpass that one because mega droughts tend to peter out after 20 years. And he said 2019 was a wet year, so it looked like the Western drought might be coming to an end. But the region dried up, in late 2020 and 2021. All of California was considered an official drought from mid-May until the end of 2021, and at least three-quarters of the state was at the highest two drought levels from June through Christmas, according to the U.S. Drought Monitor. For this drought to have just cranked up back to maximum drought intensity in late 2020 through 2021 is a quite emphatic statement by this 2000s drought, saying that we're nowhere close to the end, Williams said. This drought is now 5% drier than the old record from the 1500s, he said. The drought monitor says 55% of the U.S. West is in drought, with 13% experiencing the two highest drought levels. This mega drought really kicked off in 2002, one of the driest years ever, based on humidity and tree rings, Williams said. I was wondering if we'd ever see a year like 2002 again in my life, and in fact, we saw it 20 years later, within the same drought, Williams said. The drought levels in 2002 and 2021 were a statistical tie, though still behind 1580 for the worst single year. Climate change from the burning of fossil fuels is bringing hotter temperatures and increasing evaporation in the air, scientists say. Williams used 29 models to create a hypothetical world with no human-caused warming, then compared it to what happened in real life. The scientifically accepted way to check if an extreme weather event is because of climate change. He found that 42% of the drought conditions are directly from human-caused warming. Without climate change, he said, the mega drought would have ended early on because 2005 and 2006 would have been wet enough to break it. The study is an important wake-up call, said Jonathan Overpeck, dean of environment at the University of Michigan, who wasn't part of the study. Climate change is literally baking the water supply and forests of the Southwest, and it could get a whole lot worse if we don't halt climate change soon. Williams said there is a direct link between drought and heat and the increased wildfires that have been devastating the West for years. Fires need dry fuel that drought and heat promote. Eventually, this mega drought will end by sheer luck of a few good rainy years, Williams said. But then another one will start. Meanwhile, Daniel Swain, a UCLA climate scientist who wasn't involved in the study, said climate change is likely to make mega drought a permanent feature of the climate of the Colorado River watershed during the 21st century. Protests in Canada. Trudeau is invoking emergency powers. Prime Minister threatens to freeze truckers' bank accounts amid protests. By Rob Gillies and Ted Shaffrey, The Associated Press, Byline, Ottawa, Ontario. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau invoked emergency powers Monday to quell the paralyzing protests by truckers and others angry over Canada's COVID-19 restrictions, outlining plans not only to tow away their rigs, but to strike at their bank accounts and their livelihoods. These blockades are illegal, and if you are still participating, the time to go home is now, he declared. In invoking Canada's Emergencies Act, which gives the federal government broad powers to restore order, Trudeau's ruled out using the military. His government instead threatened to tow away vehicles to keep essential services running, freeze truckers' personal and corporate bank accounts, and suspend the insurance on their rigs. Consider yourselves warned, Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland said. Send your rigs home. Freeland, who is also the finance minister, said the government will also broaden its anti-money laundering regulations to target crowdfunding sites that are being used to support the illegal blockades. Trudeau did not indicate when the new crackdowns would begin, but he gave assurances the emergency measures will be time-limited, geographically targeted, as well as reasonable and proportionate to the threats they are meant to address. For more than 2 weeks, hundreds and sometimes thousands of protesters in trucks and other vehicles have clogged the streets of Ottawa, the capital, and besieged Parliament Hill, railing against vaccine mandates for truckers and other COVID-19 precautions, and condemning Trudeau's Liberal government. Members of the self-styled Freedom Convoy have also blockaded various U.S.-Canadian border crossings. Though the busiest and most important, the Ambassador Bridge connecting Windsor, Ontario to Detroit, was reopened on Sunday after police arrested dozens of demonstrators and broke the nearly week-long siege that had disrupted auto production in both countries. This is the biggest, greatest, most severe test Trudeau has faced, said Wesley Wark, a University of Ottawa professor and national security expert. Invoking the Emergencies Act would allow the government to declare the Ottawa protest illegal and clear it out by such means as towing vehicles, Wark said. It would also enable the government to make greater use of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, the federal police agency. One of the protest organizers in Ottawa vowed not to back down in the face of pressure from the government. There are no threats that will frighten us. We will hold the line, Tamara Litch said. Caitlin Velsia, a truck driver from Montreal protesting for more than 2 weeks, said he will move only if forced. We want only one thing, to finish with this lockdown and these restrictions. Trudeau met virtually with leaders of the country's provinces before announcing the crackdown. Doug Ford, the Conservative Premier of Ontario, which is Canada's most populous province and includes Ottawa and Windsor, expressed support for emergency action, saying, "We need law and order. Our country is at risk now." But the leaders of other provinces warned the Prime Minister against taking such a step, some of them cautioning it could inflame an already dangerous situation. At this point, it would not help the social climate. There's a lot of pressure, and I think we have to be careful, said Quebec Premier François Legault. It wouldn't help for the polarization. The protests have drawn support from right-wing extremists and armed citizens in Canada and have been cheered on in the U.S. by Fox News personalities and conservatives such as Donald Trump. Other conservatives pushed Trudeau to simply drop the pandemic mandates. He's got protests right around the country, and now he's dropping in the polls, desperately trying to save his political career. The solution is staring him in the face, said opposition conservative lawmaker Pierre-Paul Levert, who is running for the party's leadership. In other developments, the Mounties said they arrested 11 people at the blockaded border crossing at Coutts, Alberta, opposite Montana, after learning of a cache of guns and ammunition. Police said a small group within the protests was said to have a willingness to use force against the police if any attempts were made to disrupt the blockade. Authorities seized long guns, handguns, body armor, and a large quantity of ammunition. Alberta Premier Jason Kenney also said protesters in a tractor and a heavy-duty truck tried to ram a police vehicle at Coutts on Sunday night and fled. He said some protesters want to take this in a very dangerous and dark direction. Over the past weeks, authorities have hesitated to move against the protesters. Local officials cited a lack of police manpower and fears of violence, while provincial and federal authorities disagreed over who had responsibility for quelling the unrest. An earlier version of the Emergencies Act, called the War Measures Act, was used just once during peacetime by Trudeau's late father, Prime Minister Pierre Trudeau, to deal with the militant Quebec independence movement in 1970. The demonstrations have inspired similar convoys in France, New Zealand, and the Netherlands. U.S. authorities have said that truck convoys may be in the works in the United States. Invoking emergency powers would be a signal to Canadians and allies like the United States and around the world who are wondering what the hell has Canada been up to, Wark said. Also Monday, Ontario's premier announced that on March 1st, the province will lift its requirement that people show proof of vaccination to get into restaurants, gyms, and sporting events. The surge of cases caused by the Omicron variant has crested in Canada. We are moving in this direction because it is safe to do so. Today's announcement is not because of what's happening in Ottawa or Windsor, but despite it, Ford said. The Ambassador Bridge, which carries 25% of all trade between the two countries, reopened to traffic late Sunday night. The interruption forced General Motors, Ford, Toyota, and other automakers to close plants or curtail production on both sides of the border. Some of them have yet to get back to full production. Immigration. Migrants left in limbo after policy change to help border officials, by Aline Sullivan, the New York Times Company, Byline, Washington. A Haitian couple and their young son were among thousands of immigrants whom U.S. officials decided to allow entry through the southwest border last summer, part of a record-setting surge in unauthorized crossings over the past year. Beginning last spring, immigration officials were so overwhelmed that they admitted tens of thousands of migrants while issuing them a new document that did not include the typical hearing dates or identification numbers recognized in the immigration court system. The change sped up the process of releasing them into the country, but also made it much harder for the new arrivals to start applying for asylum and for the government to track them. Months later, the government has not been able to complete the processing started at the border, showing how ill-prepared the system was for the surge and creating a practical and political quagmire for the Biden administration. President Joe Biden pledged as a candidate to fix the country's broken immigration system, a campaign mantra that resonated with many voters after the harsh policies of former President Donald Trump. But over Biden's first year in office, his administration's response to the surge in migration has consisted largely of crisis-driven reactions, including the faster entry process. Migrants were caught crossing the southwest border illegally more than 2 million times between December 2020 and December 2021, the largest number since at least 1960. They came not just from Central America and the Caribbean, but from around the world, many fleeing persecution and economic hardship with the expectation that Biden would be more welcoming than Trump. Although migrants were expelled in a little more than half the cases, more than 400,000 of them were released into the country for a variety of reasons during Biden's first year in office. Of those, more than 94,000 were released through the sped-up process, a streamlined version of a long-time practice that critics call catch-and-release, in which those who are apprehended at the border are released from custody pending their immigration court proceedings. These immigrants were instructed to register with Immigration and Customs Enforcement within 60 days to complete the process the border officials started. But in some parts of the country, local ICE officers were overwhelmed and unable to give them appointments. So the Haitian family and other new arrivals have spent months trying in vain to check in with ICE and initiate their court cases. It was a quick fix. Deal with them later, said Evangeline Chan, an immigration lawyer in New York, but they have not been able to. Human rights advocates say the change has made it harder for those seeking asylum to get by while they wait to be officially recognized in the immigration system. Republicans, in the meantime, have pounced on the Biden administration for releasing immigrants without legal status into the country with even less ability to keep track of them. Those who cross our border illegally should be detained and deported, not released into the interior of our country on an unenforceable promise to reappear. 80 Republican House members wrote in a letter to Immigration and Customs Enforcement earlier this month. It is nothing short of reckless. Toward the end of last year, the government started issuing a different document to many of the migrants it allowed in, instructing them to report to an ICE office within 15 days instead of 60. But that, too, did not provide a court date or official identification number. As of the end of January, nearly 33,000 immigrants who were issued documents without court dates and the typical identification number had missed their deadline to check in and start their proceedings in immigration court. According to an ICE official speaking on condition of anonymity, it is impossible to know how many have tried to check in with ICE to get court cases started and how many have chosen not to. Hopeful that immigration will prove a potent campaign issue, Republicans are blaming Biden for the sharp increase in migrants at the border because of his campaign promise that his administration would be more welcoming than the last. His response to the surge, they say, has only made things worse. DHS was forced to deal with an unmitigated disaster, and notices to report was one of the desperate policies it implemented trying to cope. Senator Ron Johnson, Republican of Wisconsin, said in a statement, the streamlined document known as a notice to report, he added, just exacerbated the problem. Some immigration advocates agree. This NTR situation is a huge mess that everyone is trying to navigate right now, said Emily Haverkamp, an immigration lawyer and expert on asylum policies. The potential for complications with the expedited processing was not lost on some members of the Biden administration, according to several current and former administration officials who spoke on condition of anonymity to discuss the internal debate. But some officials in the Department of Homeland Security argued that border officials could not have handled the surge of migrants without the expedited option to release them into the country. The department has launched an operation to mail those who were processed at the border the faster way, a summons to appear in immigration court, but has not reached all of them. After setting off last June on a treacherous journey from Chile, where they had relocated years earlier, the Haitian family made it to Texas in August, where border officials released them without a court summons and told them to report to an immigration office once they reached Miami, their destination. When they did so, the office was closed, operating on a reduced schedule because of the pandemic. When they tried to register online, they were told they would not get an appointment to finish their paperwork and receive official identification numbers known as alien numbers until 2032. When they wrote to an ICE email address, the automated response said the agency needed the family's alien numbers. It's a vicious cycle, the husband said through a translator. The Haitian couple, like most new immigrants, are not authorized to work, making it impossible to earn an honest living. They are residing with other Haitian immigrants in the Miami region. They tried for months to enroll their son in kindergarten, facing bureaucratic roadblocks at every turn. They cannot afford a lawyer to help them find a way to comply with the government. Some of their challenges are standard for people stuck in the broken immigration system. Other challenges are new, resulting from the fact they were released without being enrolled in immigration court proceedings. You're more under the radar and you're more in the shadows, Ruby Powers, an immigration lawyer in Texas, said. Ukraine tensions. Kremlin sees a diplomatic path by Vladimir Zhukov and Yuris Karmanov. The Associated Press, byline, Moscow. The Kremlin signaled Monday it is ready to keep talking with the West about security grievances that led to the current Ukraine crisis, offering hope that Russia might not invade its beleaguered neighbor within days, as the U.S. and European allies increasingly fear. Questions remain about Russian President Vladimir Putin's intentions, however, and countries are evacuating diplomats and on alert for possible imminent war amid the worst east-west tensions since the Cold War. On a last-ditch diplomatic trip, Germany's chancellor said there are no reasonable reasons for the buildup of more than 130,000 Russian troops on Ukraine's borders to the north, south, and east, and he urged more dialogue. Britain's prime minister said Europe is on the edge of a precipice, but added there is still time for President Putin to step back. France's foreign minister, Jean-Yves Le Drian, told French television that all elements were in place for a strong Russian offensive, but nothing shows today that Putin has decided to launch one. Despite warnings from Washington, London, and elsewhere that Russian troops could move on Ukraine as soon as Wednesday, Monday's meeting with Putin and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov suggested otherwise. At the session with Putin, Lavrov argued that Moscow should hold more talks with the U.S. and its allies, despite their refusal to consider Russia's main security demands. Moscow, which denies it has any plans to invade Ukraine, wants Western guarantees that NATO won't allow Ukraine and other former Soviet countries to join as members. It also wants the alliance to halt weapons deployments to Ukraine and roll back its forces from Eastern Europe, demands flatly rejected by the West. The talks can't go on indefinitely, but I would suggest to continue and expand them at this time, Lavrov said, noting that Washington has offered to conduct dialogue on limits for missile deployments in Europe, restrictions on military drills, and other confidence-building measures. Lavrov said possibilities for talks are far from being exhausted. His comments, in an appearance orchestrated for TV cameras, seemed designed to send a message to the world about Putin's own position, namely, that hopes for a diplomatic solution aren't yet dead. Putin noted the West could try to draw Russia into endless talks and questioned whether there is still a chance to reach agreement. Lavrov replied that his ministry wouldn't allow the U.S. and its allies to stonewall Russia's main requests. Firm. Trump's financial statements aren't reliable. By Michael R. Sizak, The Associated Press, Byline, New York. The accounting firm that prepared former President Donald Trump's annual financial statements said the documents, used to secure lucrative loans and burnish Trump's image as a wealthy businessman, should no longer be relied upon, after New York's attorney general said they regularly misstated the value of assets. In a letter to the Trump Organization's lawyer Wednesday, Mazars USA LLP advised the company to inform anyone who had gotten the documents not to use them when assessing the financial health of the company and the ex-president. The firm also said it was cutting ties with Trump, its highest profile client. Mazars' letter, made public in a court filing Monday, came just weeks after New York Attorney General Letitia James said her civil investigation uncovered evidence that Trump and his company used fraudulent or misleading valuations of its golf clubs, skyscrapers, and other properties to get loans and tax benefits. While we have not concluded that the various financial statements as a whole contain material discrepancies, based upon the totality of the circumstances, we believe our advice to you to no longer rely upon those financial statements is appropriate, Mazars General Counsel William J. Kelly wrote to his Trump Organization counterpart, Alan Garten. Kelly told Garten that Mazars could no longer work with Trump because of a conflict of interest and urged him to find another tax preparer. Kelly said several Trump-related tax returns still needed to be finished, including those of the former president and first lady. The Trump Organization said in a statement it was disappointed that Mazars has chosen to part ways, but took Kelly's letter as a positive because the accounting firm hadn't found material discrepancies in Trump's financial statements. The letter confirms that after conducting a subsequent review of all prior statements of final condition, Mazars' work was performed in accordance with all applicable accounting standards and principles, and that such statements of financial condition do not contain any material discrepancies, the Trump Organization said. This confirmation effectively renders the investigations by the DA and AG moot. Kelly said Mazars performed its work on Trump's financial statements in accordance with professional standards, but that it could no longer stand by the documents in light of James's findings and its own investigation. Kelly said Mazars' conclusions applied to Trump's 2011 to 2020 financial statements. Another firm handled Trump's 2021 financial statement. James's office included a copy of Kelly's letter in a court filing as she seeks to enforce a subpoena to have Trump and his two eldest children, Donald Jr. and Ivanka, both of whom have been Trump Organization executives, testify under oath. A state court judge, Arthur Engoron, is scheduled to hear arguments Thursday in the subpoena dispute. In news briefs, judge plans to dismiss Palin's suit against Times, Byline, New York. A federal judge said Monday that he planned to dismiss Sarah Palin's libel lawsuit against the New York Times, ruling that her legal team had failed to meet the extremely high legal standard required to prove that the newspaper defamed her when it published a 2017 editorial erroneously linking her to a mass shooting. The move came as the jury was still behind closed doors in a lower Manhattan courthouse deliberating on the case. In an unexpected and unusual decision, the judge, Jed S. Rakoff, said he would allow the jury to continue working. If it rules in favor of Palin, he will set aside their verdict and dismiss the case, he said. He indicated that he understood his word would not be the last one in the case. Palin is likely to appeal, and his decision to allow the jury to continue weighing the evidence was intended to avoid any complications should the case continue through the courts. Prosecutor, Arbery's killers known to use racist slurs, Byline, Brunswick, Georgia. The three White men accused of killing Ahmaud Arbery had histories of making racist comments or using slurs in text messages that stunned their friends and colleagues, a federal prosecutor told jurors Monday as the trio stood trial on hate crime charges in the 25-year-old black man's death. During opening statements in the case, defense attorneys admitted their clients had each expressed offensive and indefensible opinions about black people, but they insisted the trio's pursuit of Arbery as he ran in their neighborhood was prompted by honest, though erroneous, suspicion that he had committed crimes, not by his race. McMichael and his father, Greg McMichael, armed themselves and chased Arbery in a pickup truck after he ran past their coastal Georgia home on February 23, 2020. A neighbor, William Roddy Bryan, joined the pursuit in his own truck and recorded cell phone video of Travis McMichael blasting Arbery with a shotgun. Arrest came only after the video leaked online 2 months later. Two cops planned to testify about Floyd killing. Byline, St. Paul, Minnesota. Federal prosecutors rested their case Monday against three former Minneapolis police officers charged with violating George Floyd's civil rights, setting the stage for two of the officers to soon take the stand as part of their defense. The prosecution rested its case after nearly 3 weeks of testimony from doctors, police officers, and bystanders, including the teenager who recorded widely seen video that showed Officer Derek Chauvin pressing his knee onto Floyd's neck while the 46-year-old black man was handcuffed, face down, and pleading for air. J. Alexander Kyung, Thomas Lane, and To Thao are broadly charged with violating Floyd's constitutional rights while acting under government authority. Kyung knelt on Floyd's back, and Lane held down his legs while Thao kept bystanders back. Camilla tests positive for the coronavirus. Byline, London. Camilla, the wife of Prince Charles, has tested positive for the coronavirus 4 days after her husband was reported to be reinfected. Clarence House, their royal household, said Monday. The announcement is likely to fan further concerns about the health of Queen Elizabeth II, who was in contact with Charles, her eldest son, 2 days before he tested positive. Buckingham Palace has not commented on the Queen's condition since last week, when it said she was not exhibiting symptoms of COVID-19. The palace has declined to say whether the Queen, who is 95, had been tested for the virus. She was scheduled to hold video calls with foreign dignitaries from Windsor Castle this week. Woman killed by man who followed her into apartment. Byline, New York. A woman was stabbed to death inside her Lower Manhattan apartment by a man who followed her from the street into her building, authorities said. Christina Yuna Lee, 35, was found fatally wounded in her bathtub at about 4:30 a.m. Sunday, police said. The suspected killer was taken into custody after he tried first to flee down a fire escape and then barricaded himself inside the apartment, a police spokesperson said. Police announced Monday that Osama Nash, 25, was arrested on charges of murder and burglary. It wasn't clear if he had an attorney who could comment on the charges. Officials, including New York Governor Kathy Hochul and New York City Mayor Eric Adams, denounced Lee's killing as the latest in a string of unprovoked attacks on people of Asian descent. These were from Denver Post Wire Services. Gun measure clears first hurdle. Bill will prohibit people from openly carrying firearms at polling places, by Nick Coltrane, the Denver Post. Openly carried firearms, while legal in much of Colorado, are closer to being prohibited at ballot drop box and voting locations as lawmakers try to ease the minds of voters who may feel menaced by armed people while casting their votes. Under the Democrat-led Vote Without Fear Act, it would be a misdemeanor to openly carry a firearm at or within 100 feet of a ballot drop box, building with a polling location, central counting facility, or other places where election administration is happening. It would exempt private property owners openly carrying firearms on their property and law enforcement officers. The prohibition also does not include concealed firearms. The bill, House Bill 22-1086, passed its first committee Monday on a party-line vote. The House State Civic, Military, and Veterans Affairs Committee sent the bill to the full House of Representatives for consideration, with 7 Democrats in favor and 4 Republicans opposed. Proponents argued some people are openly carrying guns as tools of intimidation and cited the country's history of Jim Crow-era voter suppression and today's on-edge discourse around election laws and lies about the 2020 presidential election. We have a long history of people being intimidated with firearms, and quite frankly, the people who intend to intimidate them bring them for a reason, because of how final the outcome could be, sponsor Representative Jennifer Bacon, Democrat of Denver, said. Supporters of the bill included local election officials, including Adams County Clerk and Recorder Josh Ziegelbaum, saying he wears a bulletproof vest on occasion, and Denver County Clerk and Recorder Paul D. Lopez, likening some of the intimidation efforts to terrorists when people can't tell if the armed people are friends or foes. Sponsoring Representative Tom Sullivan, Democrat of Centennial, characterized the bill as about voting rights, not gun rights. "We're not taking anything away from anybody," Sullivan said. "We just want people who are there to vote to be able to go and vote freely." While the bill aims to help voters who may feel intimidated by openly armed people at polling places, its opponents largely questioned it from the opposite poll. What about people who fear areas where only people willing to flout the law are armed? "Frankly, I fear gun-free zones, and this bill essentially creates a fear for people who believe the same as me," committee member Representative Patrick Neville, Republican of Castle Rock, said. Neville cited the shooting at the STEM school Highlands Ranch, which he called a gun-free zone, where 2 students killed classmate Kendra Castillo and wounded 8 others in 2019. While the bill would not prohibit people from carrying permitted concealed firearms at polling places, some gun owners are reluctant to register for it for fear of landing on a government database, Neville said. Committee member Representative Dan Woog, a Republican of Erie, questioned why the bill was so narrowly limited to firearms and not other weapons that might be openly wielded, such as bats. "Measures like this prey on people's fear to take freedoms and give government power in return," he said. Representative Mary Bradfield, Republican of Colorado Springs, decried voter intimidation, but said that her constituents sent her to the Capitol to protect their Second Amendment rights. "Voter intimidation is wrong at any time. It was wrong in the past, it's wrong today, and it's going to be wrong in the next election," Bradfield said. "But I see what happens here with the passage of this bill is what my constituents will see as their Second Amendment rights beginning to be eroded. That is troublesome." Aurora explosions. Ex-police sergeant gets jail time for buying rifle for felon, by Lee Schmelzer, the Denver Post. A retired Aurora police sergeant will spend 3 months in jail for knowingly buying a rifle for a felon who a few months later detonated 2 bombs in residential neighborhoods. Curtis Christensen, 70, pleaded guilty in December to 1 count of firearms straw purchase, a Class 4 felony. Arapahoe County District Court Judge Ryan Stewart on Monday sentenced Christensen to 90 days in jail, 4 years on probation, and 75 hours of community service, online court records show. As part of the plea deal, prosecutors agreed to dismiss a charge of tampering with evidence and a charge of being an accessory to a crime. Aurora police arrested Christensen in March while investigating the 2 explosions. Nobody was injured during the explosions on March 25, 2020 and January 7, 2021, but the blast propelled shards of shrapnel up to 2 inches wide through the windows and walls of 3 houses. Christensen rented a room in his home to the bomber, Scott Campbell, who used to date his daughter. Campbell, in January, pleaded guilty to attempted first-degree murder and possession of a weapon by a previous offender and was sentenced to 20 years in prison, according to online court records. Police served a search warrant on an address connected to Campbell and found bomb-making materials, a handgun, an AR-15 rifle, and a partially constructed pipe bomb, according to an affidavit for Campbell's arrest. Investigators with his former employer confiscated Campbell's phone after his arrest at Christensen's house and found messages between Campbell and Christensen. Christensen, who retired from the Aurora Police Department in 2006, helped Campbell hide the car and trailer Campbell used during the bombings, according to the former sergeant's arrest affidavit. Christensen then donated the car several days later, which investigators believe was an attempt to hide evidence. The messages showed that Christensen bought a rifle in October for Campbell, who could not legally do so alone because he was a felon, according to the affidavit. Christensen's wife also told investigators that her husband bought the gun for Campbell. Campbell's criminal history in the Denver area spans two decades and includes arrests for domestic violence, robbery, and driving under the influence. Masks. Boulder County drops mandate for public indoor spaces and schools by Sam Tabachnik, the Denver Post. Boulder County residents, visitors, and students and teachers in district schools will soon no longer be required to wear a mask. County health officials on Monday night voted unanimously to drop its mask mandates, becoming the last metro area county to do away with the face covering requirement as COVID-19 rates continue to drop precipitously. Masks will no longer be obligatory beginning Friday at 5 p.m. in public indoor spaces and in schools, including early childhood centers and for kids under five. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.